Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So I'm thrilled today to be joined by the Baroness Mayor, Catherine Mayor, who's widow of the late Sir Christopher Mayor, but is someone who's suffered an awful lot of losses in her life, more than probably anybody I've spoken to so far. I wonder, Catherine, if you're prepared to talk about some of these losses right back to the beginning?
Yes.
So what was your first loss that you encountered?
I suppose it was my best friend when we were at school together at the French Lycée. And we were very close and we did everything together and we spent our holidays together and we moved to Paris to university. And in fact, I introduced her. It was a friend of mine, close friend, who became Camilla's boyfriend. And so we used to go out, the four of us as well. So it was a really a strong bond. Plus, she was a very grown-up girl for her age because she had had quite a difficult life. And then one day, just before Christmas, her boyfriend and she were driving in England and they were going to Worthing. And it was at night and it was an accident and she died instantly. And I was alone in London. My parents were in the mountains and we were supposed to meet up the next day. And it was such a shock because, I mean, we were 19 and at that age, you don't think of death. And my parents didn't understand, really. And they stayed in the mountains. And so I felt very betrayed by God. And so I went through all sorts during that time in your sort of development when you're 19, 20, you start thinking about philosophy and religion. And so I decided there can't be a God if he takes away people like that. Anyway, it took me a long time to handle, you know, losing my best friend. Because my parents they weren't the type to sort of go into emotions, especially not my father. They both had a very difficult life and he was brought up by the Jesuits and they were both pretty strict. So we didn't really talk about things like that at home.
And because she was your best friend, I guess you didn't have any other friend like that you could confide in.
I had friends, but not, you know, not like her. I mean, totally not like her. And in fact, it was basically, as I said, she was much more mature than me. And so I depended on her a lot. And so it was a very great void in my life when she died. And I started writing poems and writing to an imaginative God who didn't exist. And so I was lurking in my bedroom for maybe a year or two, not really enjoying life.
But writing was a way of expressing your feelings?
Yes. Not that I write very well at all, but that was the way I dealt with it.
So let's go on to your next loss, which was something that many people would find it really, really hard to contemplate. Would you like to describe how you lost your sons?
Yes. I mean, that was another pretty traumatic time, and that lasted for a long time, is that I was married to a German, and we had two sons, and we lived in London, and we moved to Germany, and it just didn't work out. And so I returned to the UK, I was separated, and the children went to the French Lycée, as they did when we were living in Germany. And then after less than a year, actually, I sent them on holidays to visit their father, And 5 days before they were due back, he sent me a letter saying they're not coming back. And that was the end of that. And most people think this is impossible. How can it happen? And it did happen. I mean, in an instant, your whole world sort of totally collapses. And I couldn't reach them. Every time I was calling their house, either my ex-husband or his mother would answer saying they're not around. Call later. I called the police. It was in a small town in Germany. The police wasn't interested. And so I started sort of calling friends. And they said, well, this is child abduction. It's illegal. And so I ended up in the High Court. The High Court of Justice ordered, under the Hague Convention, the immediate return to the of the children to the United Kingdom because it was in breach of our custody agreement. And so time went on, letters, lawyers. Previous to going to the High Court, my lawyer wrote to my ex-husband saying, you know, if you don't return the children, we will go to court. And he went back and says, I'm not returning the children. So we went to court. Then a few weeks later, there was a hearing in Germany. So I flew to this very small town in Lower Saxony. The children were not at the courthouse. I was there with a lawyer. Somebody told me about this lawyer who never dealt with cases like that. The judge of the small town, the first judgment was the children should return to the UK immediately. My ex-husband said, can I say goodbye to the children? I'll bring the children to the court. And he left and disappeared. And so that was just, I can't describe it how it was. And then he just ran off with his sister, the children, and they went to another town, in a small town in Germany where they had an appeals court. And he lodged an appeal. And in Germany, unlike in the United Kingdom, the judge can make an ex parte decision, meaning without your being informed or your being present. And so the judge decided, and I found out later that, in fact, my ex-husband's sister used to work in the Ministry of Justice in the small town. Anyway, so they decided the children should not return. There'll be another hearing. So I come back to London. I'm in tears. Everybody surrounds me, actually. And that's when somebody said to me, you know, the only solution now is to go to the press. And so there was a lot of articles about my case. How is it possible? Here are those children. They are half, they have a British, a French, and a German passport. This is, you know, is this what we mean by the European Union? And it was the first article in the Spectator. It was on the cover of the Spectator. And in those days, my children were wards of courts. So they didn't go through their name was not published, but they had fake names. But the story was in the media, and it actually scared me actually to be in the media. And then eventually this second case happened in Germany, and the judges just said, well, now that the children are used to being in Germany, it'd be too traumatic for them to return to the UK, and they should stay here. And then after that, I went to kept on going to Germany to try and get visitation rights. I couldn't get visitation rights because they were saying that it would be too traumatic for the children to see me. I mean, I can't, it was so Kafkaesque, and it was just horrible. And it went on for 10 years until my eldest son contacted me. But the silver lining in all this is through this horrible story that I had been fighting already for 3 years, nearly 4 years, I went to lobby the new British ambassador to Germany. And he happened to be a single man who was in Bonn. And I think when he arrived, there were probably a queue of women, sort of single British ambassador arriving. And I went to see him. He always tells the story because what happened before I went to see him, I sent him my book because all the MPs that I got to know in the UK who were supporting me, there were a lot of conversations about my case, actually, in the UK. And they said, you must approach this new ambassador. He's just arrived in Bonn, and I'm sure he'll be able to help you more. And before he went to Germany, he had to go in front of the Foreign Affairs Committee, And he was asked about my case. What are you going to do about Catherine Lyle, my maiden name case? So he knew about my case. So I write to him and he got a bit in a panic. You know, what should he do about this poor woman who's got this problem with the German courts and she can't see the children? So he writes back to the Foreign Office, what should I do? And so he's waiting for a reply from the Foreign Office, but the Foreign Office never replied. And so when I had written to him, I had sent a copy of my book as well. And apparently just before I came to visit him, he opened the book and he said, not bad. Anyway, by the time I knocked on his door at the British Embassy in Bonn, and for me going to Germany was literally like going to enemy territory. I mean, it was just, the whole thing was just horrible. And I was weighing about 4 kilos less than now, looking terrible. And I went into his office. And so he started asking questions and I kept on going back to the children. And he kept saying, oh, yes, and I'm divorced as well. I'm separated as well. And then, oh, yes, and I used to live in France. And, you know, and at the end, I thought, how weird. Why is he constantly moving away from the conversation about my children? And to cut to the chase, the moment I walked into his office, apparently that was it. He decided I was the one. And so we ended up getting married the day before he was sent to Washington.
But was he able to help you with your sons?
No. And at the beginning, it was quite interesting because at the beginning, like most people, he just didn't believe it. He said, it's not possible. And I'm an ambassador. I'm a diplomat. You know, I'll be able to deal with that. But soon after all this happened and after I'd been a lot in the media, I was approached by a bunch of other parents who had exactly the same problem. And that's what led me to set up a charity to try and deal with international child abduction, get more attention to the legal problems. And so that's what I did for many years. And that's how I ended up being in the House of Lords, because I was sent to the House of Lords by Theresa May to thank me for my work on behalf of children and families. And it was extraordinary how all those cases were so similar. Whether it was a mother who abducted the children, then the court would say, well, obviously the children have to live with the mother because a mother is important. And if it was a father who was abducting the children, they would say, well, the father is the most important person in their life, so they have to live with the father.
This is an extraordinary, absolutely unbelievable story, as you say, isn't it? And you sort of made it your life work.
Yeah.
Have you seen any improvement at all?
At one stage, we succeeded in quite a lot of things because I got 2 presidents of the United States to talk to the chancellors on behalf of all our cases. I managed to change, basically to pass 2 resolutions in the Senate and in the House of Congress, sort of naming Germany as one of the worst countries to abide by this Hague Convention. I testified in the Senate in America 2 times, in the Foreign Relations Committee in the both houses of Representative and the Senate. And here also I made some noises. In France, I made a lot of noises. I got Chirac to actually talk to Kohl, but to no avail. And in fact, I think that the more noises and the more attention I brought to all those cases, the more stubborn the courts and the German judiciary system was. And the excuse was always, we can't intervene. Judiciary is independent and we can't intervene. I mean, it's just...
It is horrendous, yeah. Isn't it? You've described very eloquently how you dealt with it in a factual way, in a practical way.
Yeah.
But you haven't said much about what your feelings were without your boys.
The feelings were too horrible. I mean, at the beginning, I would cry every night. It was worrying to know, where are they? You know, are they crying for you at night? And I know that the little one was really, really missing me and asking about me. Because, you know, children, when they're that small, I mean, it's not a question of men versus women or anything. It's just the fact of life. when they're small, at night when they scream, it's mummy. It's the mother is so important. And so I was worried about them. I was worried about what is being told to them. For instance, Mother's Day, what do they do? It was also physical. I was missing them physically, the cuddles, and we used to cuddle a lot. And so it was really difficult. So you had all that, and then the sense of injustice. Oh, it is so difficult to cope with. And I understand, you know, people, well, like me, you end up sort of, it becomes your whole life because you want justice to make it right. I mean, how is it possible that my children were taken away from me like this? I did nothing wrong. And what about the children? Does anybody care about the children? Is there any justice in this world? And so that was really, and that's what sort of led me to do, to set up the charity, to write a book, to work 24/7 on it. And that's how I survived. You know, in one stage, after you stop crying, you're just saying, okay, what am I going to do about this? You know, you're not helping yourself. And I think it was the fact that other parents sort of came up to me and said, and then other parents in the States, British ambassador's wife, she can't see her children. So if she can't, what's happening to us?
So your position was really useful.
Oh, yeah, I used it. Really. Oh, I was accused in one of the newspapers who didn't like Christopher or me or both, saying she's using her position. I said, bloody hell, I was using my position. I knocked on doors of every senator, of congressmen. I knocked on door. In fact, that's how I met now President Biden. You bet I knocked on doors, and not just for my case, but for all the other parents who were in the same situation. And all those parents relied on me to do that. So I think when that criticism came, I mean, both Christopher and I were saying, God, you know, how people can be so petty. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't help looking at you and thinking what remarkable courage you must have to have survived, basically.
Yeah.
What is the worst thing that can really happen to a parent, isn't it?
Well, I think it's part of my family. And in fact, what happened is, I'll give you a copy of the book, is that my mother basically had a terrible childhood. So did my father, but very different. And from the day she was born the first day of the Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution, the February Revolution. And until basically the day she married my father, she's been through wars, destitution, losing everything, and she had to survive, and so did her mother had to survive. And for her mother, my grandmother, who is called also Catherine, like me, it was that much more difficult because she came from an old Russian aristocratic family, and suddenly the revolution, and you lose everything, and you're faced with a civil war, and then they had to escape. It took them all the way from St. Petersburg down to their estate. And then by the time the Red Army came, they had to flee, and they ended up in Harbin, which was Manchuria, now is northern China. And they settled there, having lost everything, but still having something. And my grandmother set up a salon. She was an intellectual. And so, you know, they lived for a couple of years relatively fine, but always wanting to go back to their country. I mean, it's the first, really, immigration. And then the Japanese came. And so they had to flee again. And they ended up in Pekin. And then the Japanese came again, and they had to flee again. And they were getting poorer and poorer, and ending up in Shanghai. And so my mother, who grew up moving all the time, so I think she'd had a pretty tough life as well. And so I think it's generation of people having a tough life. And then my father also, he lost his mother when he was very young, and he was sent to a Jesuit school, and he was born 1912, so you can imagine how strict that was. And then he went into the French Navy. But his education of me was so strict, and maybe too strict, Because I think that not for one second I had the sense of injustice, but I never sort of said, oh, poor me, why is it happening to me? I just said, okay, this is horrible. You know, now let's do something about it. As now, unfortunately, there is very much a culture. Everything is everybody else's fault. Well, you know, as you hear, my life sounds great. I live in a very nice flat. I'm in the House of Lords. But I had my difficulties. We all have our difficulties. And I think a ground, tough education, but loving, helps.
You think that gave you a strong foundation?
I think so. I think it gave me the foundation of not stopping to feel sorry for myself. I mean, for instance, people ask me, have you been to a psychiatrist? Because I can tell you, losing my children was indescribably horrible. And in some ways, some people describe it as nearly being worse than your children dying, because death is final, you can cope with it, and people around you are there to support you. When you lose your children in ways that I did and those other parents did, a lot of people think, must be two sides to this story. So people judge you. So not only are you suffering, but people either don't believe you or judge you. Then you don't know what's happening to the children. So it's a constant. You can't, there is no end to it. You can't reconcile yourself like now we have to with our husband's death. And so I think that, yes, that not feeling sorry for myself and having this grounded education of, okay, this is what happened to you, go for it and fight. And as I said, people ask me, have you been to see a psychiatrist? And I said, strangely enough, my son is a psychiatrist. I said, what would he understand? Or she? Why should I go and talk to somebody? First of all, nobody's interested in my story. How can they help me? They won't understand. And talking about it, some people find it very helpful. I don't find it very helpful because a psychiatrist would analyze it, that I have this wall around me to protect me. I mean, when Christopher died, I didn't cry. I was standing there, I didn't cry. And I think I've got this shield around me, and I don't want anybody to go in there, because maybe if I open, maybe it all will come out. And if it all comes out, how am I going to deal with that? So I don't want to even think about it. And so I just go on. As I say, I don't think there's a right way, there is a wrong way. But it makes me not afraid of death, because I'm thinking if I die tomorrow, at least I'll find my husband. But while I'm here, I managed to publish his book, because what happened, my mother was always asking Christopher, please. She had a historian in Paris who wrote her life story, but it was basically taking all the chapters, really, we're talking about her life in Harbin and Shanghai. And it was I've got it here, it's a very dry book. And mother, who adored Christopher, wanted him to write her book from the beginning, also the period of her mother, you know, the parents escaping in Russia and World War I and the revolution. And so when Christopher retired, so he set onto this task. And at the end, and because of his editor and everything, at the end he decided to make it more as a novel. So it's, as they would say on television, it's a historical drama based on a true story with invented characters. And the day he died, that afternoon, he was on the balcony still making sort of little changes in the book. And so he had vaguely finished it, but not quite. And so my task, so that was also really good, because after Christopher died, there is so many, as you've been through, so much paperwork, bank account. I mean, all this keeps you, it's so horrible, but it keeps you busy. So you're not thinking. And then after that, the next task was the book. And so I had to edit it, because at the end, he had sort of 625 pages. So I had to reduce it to about 450 pages. And then I had it self-published just before Christmas.
So that was something that kept you occupied after you'd done all the admin. Something that kept you going. Now you've finished it though, what now?
I'm very busy with the House of Lords, so that's fine. But sometimes when there are days off, and I'm not, I mean, I usually have so many emails to deal with, stuff to read. But sometimes there are 1 or 2 days, maybe I've done it, all my work, and then there is emptiness, and I don't like that. I don't like those empty moments. But you're probably the same.
Well, I think I'm trying to fill mine up in the same way that you've been trying to fill yours up, really. So you talked briefly then about when Christopher died and how you didn't shed a tear. Could you tell me a little bit more about what happened and how
Well,
long you'd been together?
we've been together for 25 years, and he was really the love of my life, and vice versa. I mean, he was so wonderful and helped me. So many holidays we spent sort of sitting on a terrace in the south of France or somewhere writing to lawyers. And he was there all the time helping. At the end, the stuff about my children became the stuff about his children, as it were. I mean, he took it totally upon himself, as a lot of men would have been bored and fed up and jealous. And there was not any moment of that. And he really adored me. And sometimes I thought, well, why does he love me so much? I mean, it was just, and everybody could see that. And so, yeah, so losing him was really quite difficult. But I think that he knew he was dying. And it was quite strange. I mean, he started feeling, I mean, he was attacked in the tube once, I don't know if you know, 4 years ago. And I think that sort of was the last straw that really shook him. And poor Christopher had heart problems, so he had a mitral valve replacement and he had to take warfarin, which is a blood thinner. And Christopher being Christopher, he was very intellectual, he's very vivid mind, great imagination, but his body was totally uncoordinated. It was quite extraordinary. And so the number of accidents he had, it was incredible. And the problem is that when you have you're taking blood thinning, so he had a bruising of the whole body, and the number of time it took him to hospital and back and forth. And I think when he was attacked in the tube and he spent quite a while in the hospital, and they had to do plastic surgery on his face and everything. And I think that really sort of was the last straw on his body. And a little bit on himself as well, that he became less self-confident physically. But then he had also other problems, physical problems. And by the time we got to Megève in now a year and a half ago, that's in the French mountains, where I have a small little place, which he adored, and we used to go there every year, and it was our love nest. And it was a very, very hot summer. I think also COVID was quite difficult for him, because if you're not doing enough sports or going out enough in his condition, I think it weighed on him as well, both physically and mentally. And by the time we got to Megève, he was really tired and he couldn't walk very fast. And suddenly one day we parked the car, and he couldn't remember, not on which floor we parked it, or he couldn't remember that we came down by car. And so I think his brain started losing a bit of oxygen. And one day we woke up and his legs were so swollen, he couldn't put on his trousers. And I start nagging him. I said, "We have to go to the doctor." And he said, "No, I'm not going to the hospital. I'm not going to see a doctor. I'm not spending time in a hospital again." And I nagged him for a day or two, and it was absolutely no, there is no way. And so the day he died, we went downtown. He couldn't walk up, so we took the bus up. He was on the terrace finishing the book, and then we played backgammon, had a glass of wine, had dinner. And then he said, "Oh, I want to watch a boys' movie." So he sat in the armchair and watched the movie on his laptop. And I watched another movie on my laptop. And then suddenly I heard and his laptop dropped on the floor. And I looked, and I knew immediately. But it was midnight, and it was, you know, I was in the mountains, top of the mountains, nobody, and suddenly you sort of, you're in a panic. So I started opening the window, scream, au secours, you know, help, help. And then went up and down the whole building. Anyway, to cut to the chase, I have to say that the French were brilliant. I mean, the fire brigade came first, then the doctors from the hospital down in the valley arrived half an hour later. I mean, they did a pump, you know, the whole thing. And the neighbors were very nice. They were set with me the whole time. And I mean, it was just, you know, pump his heart and all this. And I knew he was dead. And I felt like saying, leave him alone, leave him alone. But I suppose the doctors have to do all this. And then he's dead. And then they say, can you sign this paper? And then what shall we do with the body? And I'm thinking, you know, and suddenly it's not Christopher, it's a body. And so they actually came an hour later from the valley and they took Christopher away. And so it was really poor because you don't have the time to say goodbye. You can't. But on the other hand, again, consolation, he died like this. He would have hated to be in a hospital. He knew that if he was going to go to hospital, they would have to do something with his heart again. He was just not prepared for it. And so my huge consolation is he died the way he wanted to die. And the funny thing is afterwards, when I came back to London, I noticed things that he had organized things. Like he knew, now she's in the House of Lords. Now we've got a nice little flat, which is convenient. She can go to the House of Lords. Now I can go. I know he said that to himself. And little bits like he had all his passwords for his laptop and, you know, the bank and things like that. Totally illegible, so much so that he couldn't even find his way around sometimes. And I kept on nagging him. I said, you should do a spreadsheet or write it properly. And lo and behold, I found out that basically during just before he died, he had recopied everything in a book. He had all prepared and he had cleaned up his office. They usually had lots of messes and papers. And so I think he knew. And my sons, they were horrified. They got very close to Christopher as well. And my younger son, who is a medic, he also said, he said he knew. And he decided to go.
And to make things easy for you, yeah. It sounds like.
Yeah. So that's
she's very
a
kind.
Huge, yeah, he was a very, very kind person. And the number of letters I received after he died, I mean, telling me how intelligent, how this and that, we all know that. But the number of people who wrote about how he had affected their lives, he helped them choose their career path, how kind he was, how sensitive he was, and that was so, wow. You know, heartwarming, and because he gave always this impression. Also, he's like me. He was a doer, walked really fast, and was totally unsentimental on the exterior. But he was a huge romantic. I mean, he would bring me red roses, take me out for Valentine's Day, you know, always things like that. Much more romantic in a way than I was.
So there's a huge hole in your life.
Yeah,
now.
Huge. Huge.
And I feel I almost don't have to ask what you're doing to fill it because you've explained how diligent you are and how hard you work. But how do you manage the emptiness?
I start eating more, drinking more. And come on, Catherine, stop it. You know, like I have the pictures and at the beginning I would look at the pictures. I like having his pictures, but I can't look at them because, no, what's the point?
That sounds very matter of fact, but
yeah,
I get the feeling you're not really very matter of fact about it.
No, but I find it difficult to talk.
And what about other people? Have you had much support from other people?
Yes, but I'm sure as you've experienced, I mean, everything changes. suddenly I've got a new best friend, a female who's really nice. We knew her, but you know, and it was somebody I saw maybe once a year at a party somewhere. And she decided, after Christopher died, and she heard about it, of course, and she came to the memorial service. You know, it was an acquaintance, let's put it. And then she called me and said, look, and she's also a widow, but she's been a widow for 10 years. Let me take you out to dinner. And so we went out to dinner and we yak, yak, yak through dinner. And then we had another dinner and then yak, yak, yak. And she's got a big property in Kent. And so she's become a really close friend. And in fact, she helped me enormously to do the book launch, which we did for Christopher quite recently. And so suddenly you have sort of single women who you've become close to. And we talk about a lot of things. I mean, I like to talk about politics. I'm very opinionated and I'm not really a girly girl thing. Lots of gay friends, because it's easy. Married couples, not so much. And some of them, I just knew. They took me out to dinner once after he died. And I just knew, and they knew that I knew, we're no longer the foursome. So if I needed something, I'm sure I can phone them. But they're no longer part of my day-to-day life. It's quite... So I would say now it's gay friends, then Phyllis, and my mates in the House of Lords. But they're mates. They're not friends. None of them, for instance, invited me to their house, except one couple with whom I've become friends, but they're younger than me. So one is more alone.
What we haven't talked about is what people have said. You talked about how you've got support from your new friends, but were there things that people said to you that you found helpful and other things that you didn't like?
No, I think what I found really helpful and absolutely heartwarming was how many people admired Christopher, how many people liked Christopher, you know, not just for his brain and his personality and being a great ambassador, but how kind he was. That was so heartwarming. And so, yeah, I think the fact of knowing that my husband was loved by so many people. I mean, you have regrets, I think. Did I say to him that I loved him enough? He wanted to go on a cruise still, and I said, oh, no, because I work in the House of Lords. But, you know, you can't go and do that, because that's just making yourself miserable.
So you look forward rather than back?
Yeah. Yeah, I try to not to think so much about what I've lost, because I can't change that. But when it's things you can change, then, for instance, trying to fight about the Hague Convention working better, then I go full speed. But if I can't change, I can't bring him back. So why make myself miserable? And then I very much believe that if he's up there looking down, which sometimes I think he is, he just wants me to get on with it. I'm sure he's really proud of the book, that I've published it. I can hear him saying, yeah, well done. Or when I go to the House of Lords and I'm still shy of speaking in the chamber, I can nearly sort of, Chris, come on, girl, you can do it. So I'm doing a lot of things in a way for him, really, to make him proud.
Catherine Mayer, thank you so much for talking to me. We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello
at livingwithdying.co.uk.